You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We all deal with loss differently. In the case of Celia, the narrator of Amy Grace Lloyd's debut novel, she copes with the loss of her husband by pouring much of her attention into the small Brooklyn apartment building that she owns and lives in. But when one of her tenants sublets his apartment to a friend, Celia's carefully constructed world is shaken. The Affairs of Others is published by Picador, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
When we meet Celia, her husband has been dead for 5 years. He died when they were both young. Was his death sudden?
It was sudden in that their relationship was still pretty new. They hadn't been married long enough for the marriage to be tested by boredom or children or work. So it was still a romance. The illness came on rather suddenly, although it took him a while because it was a cancer for him to pass.
And as she grapples with her grief, Celia also becomes a landlord, buying a small apartment. Would we call it apartment building? Because it really is one of those old brownstones that gets divided up into four apartments.
Yeah, she talks about that, how it sort of defies classification, which is so important in New York when you're deciding to live somewhere. I live in a walk-up. I live in a brownstone. But it's a walk-up. It's been converted. It's also been robbed and pillaged by people over time, stained glass taken away, little details that she tries to restore. In a funny way, it becomes a little bit like her body, the way she takes care of it.
But I assume that was all before Cobble Hill became one of the more fashionable areas.
Right.
Right now, we have writers and musicians and artists all moving in there and buying houses and driving up the prices.
Absolutely. No, she's able. It's after 9/11, so it's still in that fashionable time. I think it was one of those moments, the right meeting of woman and building and bank account.
Well, she has only 4 units, and she selects her tenants based on how unobtrusive they'll be in her life.
Right.
Has she been coping with her husband's death by largely shutting herself out from the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's that wonderful tension in New York that you can be alone and be with others at the same time, that we have a sense of the collective even when we're trying to be separate. And her great goal, I think, is to live a rather monastic life, but have some sense of belonging or community in this building, because she only wants a minimal amount so she can pursue this love for her husband. She's lost her husband, but losing someone doesn't always mean you stop loving them. And that's kind of become a religion for her.
And her tenants are fairly eclectic, although totally typical. A retired ferry captain, a single school teacher, the Brownsteins, a couple that always seems to be on the verge of having a fight.
Yeah.
Now, are these based on people with whom you've lived in Brooklyn?
No, I think it's more what I am accustomed to living in Brooklyn is obviously hearing people's lives and stories through the walls and on the stairway up to your apartment. They might even offer some of their lives. I think they're composites I stole from little bits and pieces from people, but I picked people who might excite Celia's longing, her wanting to be separate, but each way, eventually as the novel goes on, the woman who moves in upstairs, Hope, sort of excites Celia's sexual desires. Mr. Coughlin, she identifies with the ferry captain because he lives so much in the past. And the Bronsteins are a married couple, a young married couple, which she didn't get to be.
Now, you've been a fiction and literary editor.
Right.
You were Playboy for years and now executive editor at Byliner Incorporated, which is a subscription site for short stories by some pretty famous fiction writers. Have you been a writer all along, or does one feed the other?
Yeah, one does feed the other, I think. I mean, I started working at Norton really early on, Norton, Simon & Schuster. In fact, I was there when Judith Regan passed through, so that was quite a startling first experience to hear her booming through the halls.
Did you learn from her other than
how to accrue power? Well, I think she was wonderful at teaching us young women how to say no to what they didn't want, and loudly, God bless her. She is a really instructive, I think, figure for how you carry power as a woman. Yeah, being an editor has been wonderful. I have seen, I idealized writers a lot. I've stopped doing that, which is a useful thing.
Well, meeting them, you realize that they all have clay feet, as do
they
the
do.
Rest of us.
They do. And I there are some marvelously kind writers out there and people with whom I'm quite close friends. And there are others who want their privacy and they don't want to engage you personally. But in terms of the range of writing and styles out there, in terms of how you conduct your life as a writer, yeah, it's been very inspiring, interesting. It can be tough to get your own work done, depending on what you're working on.
And well, do you bring the mind of an editor to your own writing, or do you need somebody else to look at it?
Yeah, I do get other people to look at it, because obviously there's a good deal of implicitness when you're inside your own story and inside a world that you're creating. But yeah, you need an editor. I needed an outside editor. But my own editor, Amy, put a period in here. Amy, this sounds like a cliche. I sometimes have to tell her to shut the hell up because she's really annoying. Margaret Atwood tells me she enjoys working with me, but man, could I be a pain in her neck.
Celia has a certain amount of rigidity. She has rules and boundaries. Is that one way that she can maintain control of the world that she's created for herself?
Yeah, a lot of Celia and is about, a lot of her character is driven about by control, how she can keep her own hunger, her own longing in control, how she can keep her relationships in control. She is someone who, again, thinks she can prescribe her existence. And so much of us, we have these plans, these notions of how we're going to go through the world, but we don't succeed. And so it's about that tension, so much of her life and the novel about that tension between surrender and control, when we have to give up control.
At the beginning of the novel, she almost seems to be a shut-in. And writers can often be shut-ins. So they spend an awful lot of time alone in a room.
Yeah, and I think from my vantage as a Playboy editor, and not just, I edited, obviously, the New York Review of Books Classics. I was an associate editor.
Wait, I just want to understand. Yeah. As a Playboy editor, you were the person responsible for all of those excuses that people had when they they said, I don't look at the pictures, I just read the good short stories.
Yes, it's a line, but it's true. I was trying to put some smart stuff in there. But to do that, I had to be out there a lot. I had to be emailing and phone calling. And if Andrew Wiley said no to me, I had to say, well, why are you saying no to me? I had to keep pitching myself out into the ether. Whereas you're exactly right. Celia's existence, at least in theory, is very monastic. And that was a little bit of wish fulfillment for me. I wanted to be alone in Greta Garbo fashion, but couldn't quite achieve it. So, yes, I hope I gave people a good excuse to read Playboy. And while I was doing that, I was around 2009 thinking about Celia and this voice that could lead me into another place entirely.
And were you also thinking about Hope, who is aptly named here? How does she come into Celia's building and into her life?
She comes in just recently betrayed by her husband. Her husband's fallen in love with a younger woman, which, of course, is a cliche, but that doesn't stop it from happening all the time. And she's charismatic and beautiful, a woman of a certain age who's still quite a dynamo sexually and otherwise. And Celia is very drawn to her at the same time she's trying to keep out of her life. But Hope takes up rather with a man and starts a very noisy affair. Celia is brought into this simply because she can hear it all. And it really hits onto some of her own difficulties around trying to stay away from some of the things she's quite longing for.
Well, she's allowed Hope to rent a sublet.
Right.
Leases usually give landlord a lot of leeway in that.
Right,
and often
they
say, I don't want you to sublet.
No, and she almost says that to Hope because she can see, man, this could be trouble. The lipstick, the hair, having seen Hope around the neighborhood, she thinks that she might be French because of the way that she styles herself, but there's an openness to her, a kind of openness that Celia doesn't allow herself.
But does watching Hope go through the process of grieving for her marriage force Celia to revisit her own grieving process?
Absolutely. There are all sorts of ways in which Hope triggers Celia and both repulses her for the ways in which she sees similarities and draws her, despite herself, really attracted to this woman, even though she's trying not to be.
Well, right after her husband died, Celia had some sexual encounters with strangers.
Right.
I guess she was trying to distract herself from her loss.
Right.
Does Hope try to do the same thing?
Absolutely. I think of Les, that's Hope's lover, as a real palate cleanser, though a dark one.
Using somebody as a way to disconnect?
To disconnect, to distract from the pain that they're feeling. Also, I think to feel sexually viable because her husband's fallen in love with a younger woman. And this man, Les, is a... I describe him as a long, liquid man, bitterly handsome giant. He has got this dark power about him. Of course, he's a hedge fund manager, in which New York is lousy with, of course.
So, and Cobble Hill.
And Cobble Hill and Brooklyn Heights, where a lot of this takes place as well. So I think it's all sorts of things. It's writing herself as a sexually viable woman, even though she's an older woman. It's a palate cleanser. It's distraction. It's distracting her from the pain that she feels, which is exactly what Celia does right after her husband finally passes.
Throughout the novel, you play with the idea that having a shared wall, a floor, or a ceiling can bring a kind of intimacy. Do we really get to know our neighbors, or is that a false sense of intimacy?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that, you know, it's that quality of our pressing our faces up to the glass to want to know things, that longing to know what's going on there. You hear bits and pieces, and you can't help but put it together. When they shower, when they might make love, when they fight, we hear all these things. So you're right. We know certain things, but we don't know the full picture.
And we're curious at the same time. We feel that it's intrusive.
Absolutely. And I think we go back and forth. And I think there's a lot about New York City living that can be both very comforting to hear these noises and really irritating as hell. And new people move in above me in my current building, which is not, which is a bigger building. I used to live on Montague Street for a long time. And I'll say, damn it, they wear boots. They're stompers, baby, I'll talk to my fiancé. This is going to drive me mad.
Well, I had neighbors I liked very much who then had a child.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
When she learned to walk, of course.
Yeah. She didn't learn to walk,
problem.
She learned to run, right?
Yes. Earlier, their cats used to chase each other at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
As the novel progresses, Celia's rules, the walls, the boundaries start to crack and crumble, and she finds herself snooping in her tenants' apartments.
Right.
And that's something that used to scare me when I had a landlord who lived in the building. She starts getting too involved in their lives.
Right. The ferry captain in the story disappears. And it's funny, someone said, wow, this is sort of like a security state. And that metaphor, that comparison is apt because when the ferry captain disappears, probably Celia's favorite tenant, something...
One she's connected with first.
Right. And he's her first tenant and she's fond of him. She has so much in common with him in certain ways. It's as though the balance in the building has been ruined and her sense of security has been ruined. And so she looks in these apartments in a strange way to find where the fault lines are. I've had landlords who've gone into my apartment. I wonder if you have, because we've all had eccentric landlords over the years. She's going to...
One demanded a key from me.
Yes. Yeah, I have a friend whose landlord...
I moved out.
Good for you. I have a friend whose landlord came in and puts his mail inside... thinking that he's doing my friend a favor, but that would frighten me. That would be the beginning of a horror story. I had a very dear Greek landlord who would go in sometimes because he was always worried about gas leaks, and I always wondered, good Lord, did I put all my underwear away and my bras hanging from the doorknobs? But right, Celia goes in, and a lot of people who've read it find that really alarming, but it's not that uncommon. And again, for Celia, I think it's about a loss of control, and she's trying to reassert control in this strange way that is probably just adding more chaos to the whole picture.
You said that you wrote the novel on subways. You think that's one of the reasons that there's such a strong sense of place in it?
Yeah, and I think I'd say absolutely. And I think even on the subway, I mean, you're a subway rider. We're doing that strange dance between participating in the atmosphere around us.
Sometimes
and also,
too much.
Too much. And sometimes just trying to keep to yourself. Read your book. Write what you're writing. On the other hand, there was wonderful energy on the subway most of the time.
I wonder how you were able to write with a bumpy ride, but that's...
Well, yeah, you could make yourself sick sometimes. You got to watch. I also did a lot of reading on the subway, and I missed my stop on the A train, for example. That's quite scary because you can end up on 125th Street.
Your novel's been compared to both Rear Window and... You mean that suddenly the express
takes off? Yes, because you miss your damn stop, right?
The novel's been compared to Rear Window, Claire Massoud's novel, The Woman Upstairs. Do you think they're apt comparisons?
Well, I do. I love Claire Massoud. I wish that we would make a day in her honor because she's been, I think, brilliant about talking about women who are allowed to be angry, women who are allowed to be unreliable narrators. There's so many examples of male characters, unreliable characters, Humbert, and people you wouldn't want to be friends with, Oedipus, any of the characters in The Corrections. I think it's apt in that you read a book, and I hope you'll read The Affairs of Others, not to find out whether Celia could be your friend or not, but is she alive? Is she teaching you something about life and how we survive and how we find light in the dark, which is what I think Celia does.
Well, talking about narrators, trusting narrators,
right.
You've said that James Salter's The Sport and the Pastime strongly influenced your writing. Now, there's a man who writes miracles of sentences.
Oh, my God. The sentence making is just delicious and sometimes quite long, sometimes quite spare. I know in your previous interview you were talking about Proust. What's wonderful about James is he's read Proust. He is European inflected, but also an American writer in that, again, very spare, very lush, long sentences. He can really do it all, and the sensuality in his books, whether describing a meal or a sex scene, you just feel alive. And even when the books are quite sad, like Light Years, it's redemptive because of how artful he is.
Now, I'm assuming you came here on the subway. Were you working on another book?
You know, Leonard, I took a car service because I wanted to be pretty for you. Didn't want anyone to...
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So you couldn't write?
I didn't write over here, but I was thinking about the book and about you and Playboy, and I was keeping a carnival alive in my head for you.
Is there another novel in the works?
Yes, there is one in the works, which I'm doing between promoting and working for wonderful Byliner. And Byliner, by the way, does nonfiction as well. And it is a wonderful endeavor, very idealistic. So I must encourage people to look it up, byliner.com. You can write at a length you need to write as magazines are shrinking. But, yeah, around all of that, I am working on a new novel.
Amy Grace Lloyd's current novel, and Lloyd, by the way, is spelled L-O-Y-D.
Yeah, we lost an L.
You lost an L there.
Yeah, it's on the lam. Let me know if you find it.
The book is The Affairs of Others. It is published by Picador. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.